Yeah, maybe I'll do the questions first of all, and then the people who are really late, they can actually get the talk at the end. So here comes question number one, which is, I say, it's a lecture note. 1, 2, 3, 4. So please, one person, one question per day. So find out your most important question. Otherwise, you get so many questions. Anyway, here we go. Question one. Eye conscious, ear conscious, nose, taste, touch, and sixth conscious, mind. Seventh, mind is C. Eighth consciousness. Jeepers, I only counted up to six, but I read. Is this eighth consciousness the last it is, the human body, when we die? Eighth consciousness, there's no such thing as eighth consciousness. Six is enough. But, you know, because it's Chinese and eight is a lucky number, so you have to have an extra couple of consciousnesses. Sometimes six consciousness is enough suffering, so that's all we've got. Is this eighth consciousness the storage of our past life thoughts? No. Is this eighth consciousness that transmigrates? No. Spirit, lots of people say trees have spirits. Yeah, the Buddha actually said that. But then either the people are the living in the trees, especially these very, very, very big and old trees. Sometimes they have the abodes of very powerful spirits because they're very old trees. So if you have an old tree, this is actually a story from Australia. It's a very strange story, but it's true. The first year I was in Australia, there was an Asian lady getting married to an Australian, and in the back of their house they had this huge old tree, and the husband wanted to cut it down, you know, because it's, you know, cutting out the view and cutting out the lights, huge tree in the garden. He had other plans for the garden, and the night before he was about to cut it down, his wife had a dream, saying, "Don't cut me down." And she told her husband, "Look, I had this dream. He's not supposed to cut this down." Now this guy was an Australian, and so Australians are just so unsuperstitious. And he said, "I don't care, that's just a dream, you're just imagining things. You Asians are all the same." Actually, Australians, they're also Asians, Caucasians. So he cut the tree down, and just to prove a point to his wife, he got his two children to urinate on the tree stump. You know, that was just how... what he wanted to prove, just superstition. And a few weeks later, this is no joke, he was diagnosed with cancer, and his two children had urinary infections. And she was so taken aback by that, you know, the coincidence was just too great. You know, that before he was fine, now he was diagnosed with a cancer, and the two kids, maybe six or eight, had his urinary infections because he asked them to urinate on the tree stump. And that's when she came and saw the monk. And said, "What can we do?" And said, "Look, the only thing you can do is go and take some flowers and incense and ask forgiveness of a tree stump." And she said, "My husband won't allow me to do that." He said, "Do it when he's at work." And that's what she had to do. And I think the urinary infections cleared up, but I'm not sure what happened with the cancer. It's weird, but that's one true story. So sometimes you've got to be very careful. So I often tell people, if there is especially a big tree and you want to clear it, go and ask permission first of all. And ask forgiveness. Say that there's some good reason here why we have to move, and just otherwise you get into big trouble. And meditation is supposed to help us get rid of the eighth consciousness. I don't know where you got this eighth consciousness from. In Buddhism, only six consciousnesses. And what actually transmigrates is just a process. The reincarnation or rebirth. The only simile, it's very tough to get a good simile to explain reincarnation. And the one I've been using recently is like a simile of a mango. Because when you have similes, you've got to have a simile which people have seen and they can understand. So a simile of a mango. So suppose it's mango season and you eat a very juicy mango and you like it very much, but you keep the seed and you plant it in your garden. And of course you can see all these stages of development of that mango seed. You can see, you know, the seed split open, a little green shoot come out. And if you plant it in the ground, you can see the time that little shoot, just like a piece of grass, just pokes up above the surface of the soil. You see that grow taller and taller, and its stem get wooden as it becomes a small sapling. You can see it grow further and further until it's just a, you know, a young tree, only a few branches and very thin branches at that. You can see it grow further until it becomes, you know, a young tree. And then you see it when it really starts to become mature, and after a few years you see it when it gets its first flowers, and then those flowers get pollinated and you see the first mangoes come. And the first mangoes, you may be lucky enough to get one which is ripe enough and you can eat the first mango. And you know there's a connection between that new mango you're eating and the mango you ate from where you got the seed many years before. What is that connection? What went from the first mango to the new mango? In fact, in that new mango, there's probably not even any molecules from the previous mango. Even the DNA has mutated and changed slightly. But there's still a connection. And the connection is the process. Cause and effect. Cause and effect. Cause and effect. Cause and effect. From moment to moment. And you can see just the whole process of one cause giving an effect. And that effect is the cause for another effect. And so on down the line of process. And that's exactly what happens. Or the best simile which I've been able to manufacture for the process of rebirth. You know, one desire creating a new mental reality, and that causing another craving which causes a new mental reality. And that's the process of mental moments driven by craving is what creates this process which transcends this moment of death and goes off into new lives. And just like the being today is not the same as the being from the previous life, nor is it different. No more is the mango different from the previous mango, but it's not the same either. If the previous mango was sweet, the new mango is likely to be sweet. If the previous mango was, say, drought resistant, the new one is likely to be have drought resistance. Because the cause and effect carries karma with it. That's the best explanation I have. So if you don't like that, then just go and die and you can maybe get a better one. So there's no such thing as eighth consciousness. So it's a bit weird. During meditation, sometimes we come across pleasant and unpleasant encounters. Good ones enjoy it for the moment and not become attached. This one is frightening. One can be disorientated and take a long time to recover. Is it true? Okay. Pleasant and unpleasant encounters. If you have wisdom, you have enough knowledge as well. Everything which happens in meditation or in life, you know this too will pass. You know, it can't really harm you, it's just there's no one there to harm. So when you understand impermanence, suffering, non-self, there's nothing which really upsets you or disturbs you at all. And that's one of the one ways that you can know that you are really enlightened, that nothing disturbs you. And even people call you stupid, idiot, dog, you're so ugly, you're the ugliest yogi in this whole retreat. And you say, okay. Now that's a sign you're enlightened. That's why if any of you come into the interview room there and say, Ajahn Brahm, I'm totally enlightened. I've got all the insights now. I'm free, I'm enlightened. And I say, look, you're a woman, women can't get enlightened. What do you mean by that? Now, of course women can get enlightened. I just say that to try and stir you up to see if there's any anger or ill will inside of you. And monks like me are very good at that. So be careful. Because if you've got anger or ill will, you're not enlightened yet. So why do I see lots of countryside, sceneries and tunnels of light heading to infinity during meditation? Okay, the tunnels, that's like a nimitta effect, which is good, so great, go for it. Go down the tunnel, see what's at the end. And countryside scenarios, oh, maybe you live so much in the city, you think the countryside is beautiful. But I live in the countryside in Australia. And people think, oh, it must be so nice being close to nature. But being close to nature means being close to mosquitoes, being close to flies, being close to all these amazing animals which crawl on the floor of the Australian forest, all wanting to eat you. So it's, people who live in the city have this great myth of, oh, it's so peaceful in nature. You go into nature and you find it's all trying to bite you or sting you. So wherever you are, you know, it's always suffering. If one meditates a long time, will one feel the discomfort gone? Or it depends on each sitting throughout one's meditation. Nice man. Each sitting is different, but look, when you get into some stillness of the mind, in other words, you sort of go beyond the body. So that's, you know, you've heard me say that yesterday. You go to these stages of meditation, present moment awareness, you develop that and you go into the silence, and in the middle of the silence you find the breath. And then you find the full awareness of the breath from beginning to the end. You don't go on to a next stage, you're always going into the next stage. And then you sort of go into this very delightful breath when the body is about to disappear. Then you go into these nimitta stages, and by that time you can't feel the body anymore. So that's when you can sit for hours. You're sitting there and you can't even feel your body. And the amazing thing is that, you know, if I sit for like an hour and a half, I'm getting old now and stiff and joints are sort of wearing out. Just like a car, you know, after 59, 60 years, there's always things which go wrong. You have to keep on having services even more often than when you were young. Oil changes and this change and whatever changes you have. Now you become a piece of work in your 70s, having gone to hospital for so many times for a checkup and a change in the lube. And after, when you meditate for like an hour or something, I'm always a bit stiff. But if you really get into samadhi, get into some deep states of meditation, you can sit there for hours, 4 hours, 5 hours, and when you get up afterwards, there's not a pain in the body. First time that happened to me, that's really weird. Now just about 3, 4, 5 hours, there's not an ache in my body at all. My body felt so light, pain-free. And it seems to be that the longer you sit in meditation, if you get into the stillness, the less pain you have. It's a wonderful feeling. So that's why sometimes that if you do get into deep meditation, you come out and there's no feeling at all, totally comfortable. Yesterday you mentioned that it is the consciousness we carry on to the next rebirth. If we learn to forgive, we will not be reborn in the woeful planes. Does this mean that a suicide bomber who thinks that he is right in killing so many people, he suffers no guilt and is not affected karmically? Now that's a nice question. Did you hear about the joke about the woman who married a suicide bomber? She went off with someone else. That's a joke. Now, she went off with someone else, means she blew herself up, but it also means that you go off with someone else, have a mistress. Anyway, that was a joke. Never mind. They laughed at that in Australia. But if a suicide bomber thinks he's doing the right thing, now look, a lot of times they think they may be doing the right thing, but when they've actually done it, they think, my goodness, what have I done? Because now after you blow yourself up, you don't totally disappear. You're there seeing the carnage and the pain and the screams and the tears and the frantic grief of the loved ones who's friends have been, or children have been blown up. So at the time you may be in denial of the karmic consequences of your deeds, but afterwards when you're standing there in your mind-made body looking at what you've done, my goodness, you will have huge amounts of guilt. You can actually deny, this is in psychological denial, oh, I'm not doing anything wrong, these people deserve to die, but when you actually do it, it's a totally different ball game. That's one of the reasons why, and I read this it's a review of a book about war, and they said that many generals, the biggest problem with training their soldiers is to make sure they pull the bullets, they sort of pull the triggers when they're aiming at the enemy. Because most soldiers, I mean, it's at war, in battles, maybe 60, 70, 80% of them, they just cannot bear to shoot the enemy who's shooting at them. They either shoot over the head, so they deliberately miss. And that means that many soldiers get killed. Even though they know they're going to die, they can't bring themselves to kill another human being. And part of military psychology is to try and demonize the enemy, trying to make them as if they're not human, they're not the same as us, to convince the soldiers to actually shoot to kill when the enemy is running at them shooting bullets. A lot of people just can't do it. You can imagine you, even if it was your life at stake and somebody was coming at you, say with a machete, could you actually pull that trigger? A lot of people would not be able to. We'd rather die ourselves than shoot another person. And that is fact, statistics from soldiers at war. So as you can see, because of that, the suicide bomber, yeah, they may sort of blow themselves up, but afterwards they realize what they've done. And my goodness, they will suffer immensely. That's not an easy thing to forgive, especially not for someone who believes in divine retribution. Ajahn, can one realize non-self without going through meditation? Why do people always want these shortcuts, the easy ways? That's why sometimes people used to say, Ajahn Brahm, can we get to Nirvana without coming to the temple and giving donations? Can we realize non-self without keeping the precepts? Can I still go to heaven and just drink a little bit of alcohol? Not much, but just a little bit. And I tell them, okay, let's be reasonable. It's all right to drink a little bit of alcohol. It's all right to do a little bit of killing and a little bit of adultery. Why do you always say a little bit when it's the fifth precept? And just the same way, even a little bit of killing will send you to jail. A little bit of adultery will cause your separation. So even a little bit of alcohol is very dangerous. So even little bits are no good. So can you realize non-self without going to meditation? Unfortunately, no. The only way to realize non-self, to become enlightened, what's the only way to enlightenment? The Eightfold Path. Ezo wa magonati anyo dasanasa visuddhiya. This is the only path, there is no other, for the purity of insight. The Eightfold Path. That's in the Magawaga in the Dhammapada. Think about 274. It's great, and we all know that. That's why just before the Buddha passed away, somebody asked him, was Subhadra, he was a wanderer, said, are there enlightened beings in other religions, in other paths? And the Buddha gave this great answer, said, look, wherever you find the Eightfold Path, there you will find enlightened people. Where there's no Eightfold Path, you don't find enlightened people. And what is the eighth factor of the Eightfold Path? Meditation. You know, the Buddha was so compassionate. If meditation wasn't really necessary, he would have given us a sevenfold path. And you would not need to spend all this time on retreats with sore knees and sore backs and not getting a proper sleep and not being able to have a shower because the water's run out. Oh, you'd have much easier paths about it. Now, sorry, this is the easy way. How do you know inside which is the doer mind and which is the knower mind? How do you strengthen the knower mind? Okay, the doer mind is the one who always asks the questions like that. That's the doer mind, okay? And the knower mind is the one who can listen and laugh. So the doer is always trying to do things. Can never sit still. Can never actually just leave things alone. Always getting their hands involved. It's just like this is a story, and again, someone had said the other day that when I tell all these stories from real life, do the people get upset and offended? No, because a lot of these people are very close disciples, and this one, I've told this story so often, and the lady has heard it in my tape so many times, but she doesn't get offended because she knows she was guilty. That what happened, that she picked me up from Heathrow Airport when I went to visit London some years ago, and because, you know, she is a woman, she got her son to drive the car. And I was sitting in the passenger seat next to the driver, who was the man, and she was sitting in the back. And she was taking me to, where was it, to Bromley in Kent, from Heathrow Airport, maybe an hour's drive. Every minute, probably twice or three times a minute, she was giving instructions to her son. Turn left, go fast, go slow, don't go this way, go that way. I've never seen in my life such a backseat driver as this woman. Now that's the doer. Always a backseat driver, telling your mind, come on, do it this way, don't do it that way, do it another way, come on, do metta meditation, no, don't do metta meditation, do anapanasati, no, anapanasati is the wrong way, let's try some vipassana, no, I'm fed up with vipassana, let's get up and do something else, now, let's take some notes, let's have a cup of tea, let's look, read a book. You're never still. So the doer is what stops you being still. Always interrupting you. And the no is just mindfulness, like the passive observer. The no is just that person who just sits on the aircraft and all these things come to them. Actually, it's a good place to put in one of Ajahn Chah's most incredibly beautiful similes. And now, I should really put this in one of the books. The last time I wrote a book, you know, I forgot it. I only sort of start remembering these things much later on. I don't think it's in any book of Ajahn Chah's, but when I first went to Wat Pa Pong about 36 years ago, this was the story he kept on repeating, a simile. He said that his monastery, Wat Pa Pong in Ubon, was a mango orchard. He said those mango trees had been planted by the Buddha. And he said that those mango trees are now mature and ripe, and there's so many ripe, juicy, sweet mangoes dripping from every branch of those mango trees planted by the Buddha. And he said, you monks these days are so lucky. You don't have to climb the mango tree to get a fruit. You don't even need to throw up a stick or shake the tree. All you need to do, because of the great compassion of the Buddha, is just hold out your hand and a mango will fall into it. And that was his simile. And at the time I could not understand a word of it. I thought this was one crazy monk. Because I've never seen mango trees. Now you go and see a mango tree outside in your garden, you put your hand out, is a mango going to fall? You could be waiting there for hours, days. And if a mango does fall, it falls over there, not on your hand. Crazy simile. But of course, after a while, you realize what he was saying. You know, those mangoes, the mangoes, they're the fruits of jhanas and enlightenment. He said, you don't have to shake your tree. Don't climb or throw sticks. Stop all this trying business. All you need to do is open your hand. Open your mind. Be still. Don't shake anything. And the fruits of enlightenment fall into your mind. You don't go climbing the tree. You don't shake anything. You don't make it happen. You open your mind with mindfulness and the mangoes fall. Brilliant. Absolutely beautiful simile. And that fellow knew what he was talking about. If you try and shake your mango tree, you'll never get anything. You'd be here all retreat, shaking, 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 trying to climb up a tree, and we never get any mango. But you let go, be still, just open your hand, and all the mangoes you'll ever want fall in. Brilliant simile. Is some subconsciousness within the mind. When you're really mindful, then the subconscious becomes available to you. You can see what's going on. It's only subconscious because you're not aware enough. Any method to practice avatar without reaching nimitta and jhana is another shortcut person. I can't see any other way. Simply because that simile of the tadpole and frog. How on earth can a tadpole know what water is? Things have got to vanish before you know what they are. Especially things which were always there. Always there so you don't notice them. That's the nature of your brain. You can only notice things which change. If something's always there and it never moves, never changes, you can't perceive it. But when it disappears, then you realize what it was. That's why much of the stuff which you think you understand, you can't. And that's the purpose of the jhanas, is to give this incredible weird experience, the change of data, to see, my goodness, now I can understand what the Buddha saw. And all of my assumptions, many of the assumptions, which stopped me being enlightened, and now eradicated. Because I've got a new reality, different way of looking, new evidence. Ajahn, we're meditating, sometimes I can feel this air energy on my palm and center of my chest. Is it normal or is it just my imagination? It's normal imagination. It's imagination. Well, now look, all this imagination business, the whole of your world is imagination anyway. Now one of my friends, this is, I like to sort of ground these answers in reality instead of getting too metaphysical, philosophical. One of my friends, I was a meditator. He had a lot of difficulty doing breath meditation. He just couldn't follow it. He never told me who this teacher was, but this teacher deserves a medal. It's a brilliant strategy. The teacher told him, if you can't watch your breath, don't worry about it. Just imagine you're watching your breath. Close your eyes and imagine you're watching your breath going in and going out. Just imagine it. Don't try and do it. Just imagine that you're watching your breath. And so he shut his eyes and he was imagining watching his breath go in and go out, go in and out. Just imagining and not doing it. And after a couple of minutes, the teacher said, what are you watching? And he said, the breath. Because the imagination and reality, there's such a small dividing line between the two. And it was just a great piece of psychology. So if you can't meditate, imagine you can meditate. Close your eyes and just imagine you're meditating. And then see what happens. Imagine you can see an emitter. Don't watch an emitter. Don't try. Just imagine you're watching an emitter. Close your eyes and imagine you've got this beautiful light in the mind, very brilliant, and it's there for minute after minute after minute. And the difference between that and real nimittas is very small. That sometimes you can make that jump very easily. Use imagination, it's very powerful. And the feeling of air on the body, that's fine. Maybe I'll actually say this now. This is part of meditation. When you get to a certain stage of meditation, it's usually when you get to delightful breath and beyond. In other words, you're getting very, very still and your body is about to disappear. That's when you get weird feelings on your body. Many people feel they're floating up in the air or their body is expanding. Some people feel their body is rocking or shaking backwards and forwards. You are not shaking. You are not rising up into the air or diving into the earth or ballooning out. You're not exploding. This is just the part of meditation. When you're getting still enough, the mindfulness is getting strong, and you're breaking through the barriers of perception, all the things you've been taught to see, now the mind is playing around. If you open your eyes, you can see that solid wall melt like chocolate on a hot day. You get weird perceptions. This is not going crazy, it's just the way the mind works. It works in a straitjacket. You're taught how to perceive. And when you get to that stage of the meditation, all that conditioning is challenged and you start to see things in a way which can't be true. Don't worry about it, it's good fun. You can enjoy yourself just watching your body balloon out, because you're not ballooning out at all, it's just a stage in the meditation. It's just like a free movie, a free light show, which just comes up in a certain stage, and when it 2 or 3, 4 minutes, 5 minutes, then it all vanishes again. And then your body really disappears. It's just before things disappear. And the other thing which happens sometimes is that you feel that your body is tingling or there's heavy weights on you. It's just, this is a case where the mindfulness is getting very strong, the body is about to disappear, and it's amplifying all the physical sensations. So the ordinary itch you feel right now, in that state of meditation, it feels just incredibly like ants over every inch of your body. Or you know, really heavy weights on you. All it is just the mindfulness getting so strong that whatever you perceive as a tactile sensation is amplified, like the sound of my voice is amplified through the amplifier into the speakers. That's all it is. Stay with it, it's interesting, and it soon disappears and your body goes. And the other interesting experience you can sometimes get at that stage is hot spots. Hot spots on your hand, on your back, women, on your breasts. Many have had that, and they wonder, what was going on, Ajahn Brahm? Part of my body was really hot. You should know that's an excellent sign. Well done, you should feel just so relieved. Some healing has happened. The classic case, which I keep on repeating, again, one woman, she came into the interview during a retreat I gave many years ago, and she said her whole neck and shoulders were just so hot. And she said, what was going on? It's like I had a fever in that part of my body. And then I told her, because I've been doing this for such a long time now, I said, when did you have your whiplash? I never told you that. She said, at last, Ajahn Brahm has told me a psychic power. He's read my mind. You knew I had a car accident and a whiplash. I'm going to tell everybody, you really are something, Ajahn Brahm. I thought, no, it's not psychic powers. It's just I know that you've had an injury in that part of the body. And what's the most common injury today to the back and the shoulders? It's a car accident when you have whiplash. So I said, I'm just adding one and one and making two, that's all. But I said, look, it doesn't matter. I can guarantee that after it was feeling so hot, you felt so relaxed and so good. And yes, it's wonderful. Healing has happened. That fever was just all your bodily energy going to where it was needed and doing some really strong healing for you. And when you are aware and awake at other times of the day, you are such control freaks, you don't let the body heal itself. And it's only at that particular time when you let your guard down, when you let go and you're watching the breath and everything is disappearing, only then does the body have a chance to do its job and heal things. Which is why many women have told me they've got hot spots in their breasts. Brilliant. There was a cancer about to come there. You've nipped it in the bud. Well done. And of course you can understand what that feels like to a woman to hear that. Because cancer is really scary. And they've done something about it. Many, many times that happens. So if you get hot spots in your body while you're meditating, brilliant. There's some disease or there's some incipient problem there. There's some old injury when you fell off a motorbike or doing sports, or even when you were a kid, that's now being healed. Brilliant, well done. So when you get those hot spots, don't interfere, don't worry about it. This is great stuff happening. You're healing your own body, getting rid of these terrible diseases. Wonderful. So that's the hot spot things which happen in the body. And then afterwards, just the body sort of disappears, and then you have a wonderful time. In doing metta meditation, can we just visualize a person who radiates positive energy and kindness towards him or her without mentally rehearsing verses like, may you be free from mental suffering, may you be free from physical suffering, may you be well and happy? Yeah, you can make up your own words. And you don't have to just, you know, be like parrots and do the words which, you know, was in the suttas 25 centuries ago. Do it in Chinese if you want. You know, just visualize a person and if you may visualize me, so may you always have lots of fish and chips, Ajahn Brahm. May your tea always be strong. May you always have things which you like, or whatever else it is. You know, just make it personalize your message, like you personalize your greeting cards these days. And if you personalize the message, it gets more powerful. And if you want to prove this, again, being a scientist, I love doing experiments. Some years ago, when I did a metta meditation for people, I really got them really into strong metta, and then at a certain time I said, now I want you to visualize someone you're very close to but who's not in this room, and just zap them with loving kindness. Blast them with that loving kindness. Surround them, infuse them, drench them with as much loving kindness as you can get. And they did that for about 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 minutes. Then I said, at the very end of the meditation, you did that at 5 minutes past 3 in the afternoon. Okay? That was the time you did that. Now when you go home, I want you to ring that friend. Give them a call. And just have ordinary conversation first of all. And write sort of maybe after 1 or 2 minutes of ordinary conversation, ask them, oh, just this afternoon, just after 3, what were you doing? Don't just say, well, you're thinking of me. Just say, what were you doing? And just, people kept on calling me back at the monastery. It worked, Ajahn, but it worked, you wouldn't believe this. I asked them, I never actually made any suggestion what I was supposed to answer. I said, what were you doing after 3 o'clock? I said, oh, that's amazing. I was really thinking of you and feeling all these incredibly wonderful thoughts about you about 3:05. Because what it does, it proves that this actually works, people receive it. So that's a good thing to do. And how does a person become a Buddha? Is it by making a vow? What is the difference between an Arahant and a Buddha? Can a person who is about to attain enlightenment choose which one to be? Okay, look. A Buddha is the first Arahant of the of the dispensation, of the series. So when Buddhism dies out and there's no Dhamma being taught, the first person to become an Arahant is called the Buddha. And everyone who comes afterwards sort of is the Arahant. So it's as if the Buddha is the first on the list. The Arahants come afterwards. They do say the Buddha has extra special powers, which you'd imagine, because he has to do it without the help of many other people. But even so, was the Buddha a self-enlightened Buddha, or did he get the seed from somebody else? He got the seed from Kassapa the Buddha. If any of you are interested in nice controversies, and I love controversies because they make things interesting, have a look in the Gatikara Sutta. Gatikara Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya. And in that Gatikara Sutta, there was Gatikara, a potter, in the time of Kassapa the Buddha. This is a previous Buddha to our one. And Gatikara had a close friend called Jyotipala. And Jyotipala, he was not interested in religion at all. Certainly not in this shaven-headed idiot called Kassapa. And that's what he called him. He called him a shaven-headed fool. And every time Gatikara said, come and see my master, he's a really, really good person, very wise man. No, who wants to go and see that shaven-headed idiot? And Gatikara used every trick in the book to try and get his friend to seek us for the Buddha. Eventually he succeeded. And when he did succeed, as soon as Jyotipala saw Kassapa, he was so inspired he became a monk and spent the rest of his life with Kassapa. And the rest of the story goes on to Gatikara, who was a non-returner, an anagami, about his encounters and how frugal he was and what his behavior was like. When the Buddha told that story, this is our Buddha told the story in the Gatikara Sutta, he said, "I was Jyotipala." The Buddha was telling a very recent previous life. In this eon, not that long ago, when the previous Buddha scolded another Buddha, said bad words about him, and would not go and see him until he was pressed by Gatikara. And then when he saw him, he became a monk under Kassapa the Buddha. So there we have, our Buddha was a monk under Kassapa. And when he sat under the Bodhi tree, before his enlightenment, what did he do? The standard sequence of events. Got in the four jhanas, first watch of the night. And then he recollected his many past lives. This was before he got the insight into Four Noble Truths. And surely he would have recollected the past life when he was a student of the most recent Buddha, Kassapa. And surely when he was a student, not of Ajahn Brahm or Ajahn Chah, but of the Buddha, you know, the boss, the great monk of Kassapa, surely he would have heard the Four Noble Truths from Kassapa, and surely he would have remembered them. So did Buddha Gautama discover them for himself, or did he remember them from a previous life as he was taught them by Kassapa, but this time penetrate them fully? Was he really self-enlightened, or was he got the seed from Kassapa? Da-da-da. Think it out for yourself. Okay, yes, Raymond, go on.
So how do we put in the paramis?
The paramis, they came later. If you look in the word of the Buddha, there's no mention of paramis. The Mahayana started the paramis with the six paramis. And then Theravada, we had to always go one better than the Mahayana. Actually, not one better, four better. So we got 10 paramis to show that we were much better than Mahayana. You know, that's terrible stuff, but that's actually what people do, you know. My master is much better than your master. How many paramis has your master got? 10. Oh, mine's got 12. So be careful of that. Paramis came later. Have a look at that. And actually, also, there's another place in the suttas, in the Devaputta Sanyutta. This is in the Sanyutta Nikaya, and that's where Gatikara, an anagami, so in the Suttavasa, came down to Bodhgaya to congratulate his old friend, who was Jyotipala in the previous life. Now, Gautama, to congratulate him on his enlightenment. There's a wonderful poem there of Gatikara. Now, the same fellow in the Gatikara Sutta saying that we lived in the same village in a previous life in the time of Kassapa. Now you've become a Buddha. Congratulations, my good friend. It's very beautiful, like one old friend congratulating the other. Read it, it's fun. Today my walking is good, but not my sitting. That's okay, you can't get everything. 50% is good enough for us. When I sit, I felt my body is moving forward and back, or moving around, and my mind just lazy and black. What should I do? I think I've already told you that if you feel your body's moving around, it probably is not. So leave it alone. Let the body do what the body wants to do. Oh, I've had it with my body. It never behaves itself. I want to give a talk, and you've got a sore throat. And then when you're not giving a talk, my throat is fine. So look, I mean, it's a crazy, crazy body. It never does what you tell it to do. So you can do what you want, body. I'm just not going to bother with you anymore. You can sit down, you can move around, you can fall asleep. I'm going to meditate. You can do what you want. Bye-bye. That's what I do. So you let it move around. And if sometimes one of them is good, sometimes the other is good. So don't worry about that. In fact, my first meditation teacher told me a great saying: there is no such thing as a bad meditation. Very brilliant advice. Because imagine this. Once there was a man who went to work on a building site on a Monday morning. He worked so hard building and laying bricks and carrying planks of wood, and at the end of the day he went back home with no money, no pay. And he thought, this work, you know, I really work hard, I'm very tired, what do I get out of it? Just tiredness. But his wife told him to go to work on Tuesday, so he went to work on Tuesday, worked really hard all day, same thing happened, no money. On Wednesday he didn't want to go, but his wife scolded him, come on, go. So he went to work on Wednesday, he worked really, really, really hard, and again got no money. And on Thursday, well, he wasn't doing anything anyway, so he went to work anyway. And again he didn't get paid. And he went on Friday, but he said, this is the last time, if I don't get paid, I'm not going again. And he went to work on Friday, he got this big pay packet on Friday. And from then on he said, I'm only going to go to work on a Friday. Well, then you get the message here. On Friday you get paid for Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday and the Friday work. You don't get paid every day. In the same way, your meditation, you've got to work, 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 and sometimes you get no paycheck at the end of your meditation, but you still have to do the work. And when the nice meditation comes, wow, I've got the paycheck. So you want every meditation to be payday. It can't happen that way. You've got to do the work. Work, 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 and then you get the paycheck. And those of you who haven't got a paycheck yet, don't worry, you've been working so much. When your paycheck comes, it's huge, because you get it all in one go. During the morning talk today, you mentioned, that must be last night, you mentioned that the second jhana one would experience no self. Does it mean the person has attained liberation, not subject to rebirth anymore? No. I said, all you can see is the will has stopped. There's no will left. And as long as you've got a little bit of insight, a little bit of wisdom, actually what's really necessary, you hear from other enlightened beings what to look out for, so you can actually see that. Think, my goodness, there's no will there. What is this will? And now you've got the means for contemplation, developing insight. You don't always get it, but as long as you've got some good teaching, and you get some understanding of what the Buddhism is all about, and you have that experience, and you have the teaching, you put them together, now you can get something. During meditation practice, when thoughts and breaths are settling down and start feeling the gentleness of various parts of the body, saliva is building up in the mouth and swallowing, thus becoming a relatively harsh action, how do we overcome this? Have you ever been to the dentist? They have these little tubes they put in your mouth when you're having some dental work done, and it sucks the saliva on. You go and get one of those. You can buy them pretty cheaply. And so when you're meditating, you can have this little thing in your mouth that sucks the saliva. Oh, that's only joking. Just swallow and have done with it. Because when we worry about it, it's not the swallowing. The swallowing is very easy. It's just the worrying about it. That's what causes the most distraction. Should I swallow? Should I not swallow? If I swallow, this is going to happen. If I don't swallow, this is going to happen. Oh my goodness, I'm going to dribble. People are going to see me. I'm going to be like a little baby or like an idiot dribbling. And they're going to get all on my road. People are going to see this. This is terrible. So I should swallow. But if I swallow, then I'm going to sort of disturb my meditation. Oh my goodness, what should I do? Let's ask a question of Ajahn Brahm. Now that's a disturbance. Because that goes on, the thinking reaction goes on a long time. The swallowing just a couple of seconds of that, and it's gone. So I just swallow. During meditation, the breath seems to move all over the place. And my body also tends to move forward, backwards and upwards. Upwards, brilliant, and levitator. If you can learn how to levitate on this retreat, imagine you will be able to go to the 2012 London Olympics for Malaysia, and you'll be levitate over the high jump, and you'll win gold medal for Malaysia. You won't need to do any exercise, just sit there under the bar and meditate, and just lift, 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 and up on the other side. So great. Yeah, okay, this is just what I was saying. The mind actually plays these tricks at that particular time. Enjoy it, you're not levitating, you're right on the ground, unfortunately. As you did mention, not to fight the body and also let go. In this instance, do I just let the body move and the head also follow the breath? Yes, just let the body do what the body wants to do. And actually, you will find it's not moving at all. It just feels that way. Now, trust me, believe me, if you doubt that, if you think you're moving, I'll get one of these cameras and I'll put it on you for the meditation. And I guarantee you'll be so surprised. I was moving and you're perfectly still. That's what it feels like. Sometimes I just feel like I'm going to fall backwards. and have to control to move forward where the meditation is interrupted. No, just fall backwards. If you really are worried about that, we'll get you a crash helmet so you can wear that during the meditation. That way, if you do fall backwards, you won't have any injuries. So you don't fall backwards, you're fine. Dear Ajahn, in the morning talk about non-self and there's no such thing as free will. Ah, you get these questions. People love worrying about free will and no will and Buddhist knows what else. And there's no such thing as free will. And even your will is conditioned. If it is so in daily life, what attitude we should have towards our strive for advancement? You've got no choice but to strive for advancement. So people think, why should I struggle? You've got no choice. You have to struggle. You're totally conditioned to struggle. So just let go and give in. Simply be at ease and not try to push things and make things happen. You try to do that and just not struggle and not push things along. You will be unable to do it because all of your conditioning of your life is created this will, and that's how it is. The important thing is know when you are struggling where that is all coming from. So simply be at ease and not try to push things or make things happen. How to let the knower be in charge instead of wasting energy by the do. You have to do something. If I didn't do anything, I would never get up in the morning. I'd just stay there and said, let go, let go, let go, and stay in bed. But no, I am conditioned to get up in the morning. The reason I'm conditioned to get up early in the morning is because Ajahn Chah conditioned me to get up really early in the morning. So I can't help myself. It's been so conditioned into me to get up early in the morning. So I just do it. But I realize it's not me getting up in the early morning. It's just all my training as a monk. That's what made me get up in the morning. And I tell silly jokes. And the reason I tell silly jokes, it's not my fault. Please don't blame me for telling silly jokes. Because my father told really silly jokes. And it's his fault. Because he conditioned me. Because you know, your father, your parents are one of the greatest influences on your life, especially your early childhood. And he would always tell these stupid jokes. I remember him telling the joke, he came back home one day and he told my mother, and I was listening, he said, oh, it's very, very sad. You know, my cousin has had a sort of a bad motorbike accident and he's lost his leg. But the worst part of it is that when he was in hospital for the operation, they took the wrong leg off. And as soon as they realised they'd amputated the wrong leg, because you know these days, actually in hospital, you know, with all the great advancements in science, they actually just put a cross on the leg. They do that. So actually there's no way that they can make the mistake. And it's very simple, that's what they do. But anyway, they made a mistake, and so as soon as they found out, they had to take him back into hospital to amputate the other leg. Had to, because it was injured badly. And as soon as he recovered, having lost both his legs, he sued the hospital. He took him to court, but he lost the case. He didn't have a leg to stand on. That was my father's joke. So not having a leg to stand on means you can't, you've got no sort of grounds for your case. But anyway, that was his sense of humour. And he imparted that to me at an early age, and so it's totally conditioned. I've got no choice but to say jokes like that, so don't blame me. It's not my free will. So you just enjoy it. So this is why you struggle or you strive, because you're conditioned to, but you want to sort of let go as much as possible. Dhiraj, you mentioned there are universes in endless time, giving limited combination of elements and events in endless time. Does that mean Nietzsche's idea of eternal return is bound to take place? And if we aspire to become enlightened, we're bound to be awakened. I suppose if you aspire, you'd eventually become awakened, but just a matter of how much time you waste on the journey. So don't aspire to be awakened, aspire to be peaceful, aspire to let go. If you get the right aspirations, it works. The wrong aspirations, it doesn't work. Because aspiring for enlightenment, do you know what enlightenment means? Really? So we're aspiring for something we don't understand. No wonder we go around in circles. You can understand what stillness is, what peace is. So aspire for stillness, aspire for peace. Then you're aspiring for something you can really get a grip on. And then you can achieve something. Buddha attained jhanas through sitting meditation. Why did he teach walking meditation? Because you can't sit all the time. You do walking meditation in between. And he also taught that walking meditation is a great support for sitting meditation. It makes the body balanced because you're exercising. And anyone who's getting very tired or tense or stiff in the body, do what I've advised many people in the interviews, do fast walking. Not the slow walking, but find a path and walk very fast, backwards and forwards, to get the energy going in your body. Because one of the problems on a retreat, we walk so slowly, it's actually sometimes bad for the health. We do things very slowly. It means we don't really get much exercise. So you find many forest masters, they do fast walking. And it really gets them fit. So if you really feel tired and dull, nothing's working, find a path and walk, you know, very briskly backwards and forwards. Don't run, but walk quite fast. Why did Devadatta retain four jhanas without perfect sila? He had perfect sila beforehand, which is why he got the four jhanas. But as soon as he got the four jhanas, he got lost in pride. What this one monk once called spiritual materialism. Look at me, I've got the jhanas, I'm better than everybody else. I've got these psychic powers, look at me. And interestingly, that when I first went to Wat Pa Phong, there was one of Ajahn Chah's monks. He got lost in that pride. And he had very powerful meditations, and he developed, this is true, I mean these things do happen, people do develop psychic powers. He developed the psychic powers of the divine ear. And he could actually hear conversations going on 5 or 6 kilometers away. And when he reported that to other monks, they checked him out, and it was true. He could do that. This was no sort of a myth. But then, because he had very strong meditation and these powers, he thought he was enlightened, and he became egotistical. And when they found that Ajahn Chah was a great teacher and could manage to show him, look, you got lost. You know, that you think that these are your attainments rather than letting go of things. And when I arrived, he had just realized his mistake, and he bowed to every monk in the monastery and asked forgiveness of every monk. And then he disappeared, and I never heard of him again. He probably went into a very sort of quiet place, and probably it was one of the arahats, because he had such great samadhi. And Ajahn Chah just went off the path a little bit into conceit, thinking, I can do all these things, what a great person I am. And that's exactly what happened to Devadatta. And as soon as he lost, as soon as he got his conceit and thought he was so good, at that point he lost all of his jhanas. He couldn't get them back again. Because when you do lose your sila, you lose your powers. It's one of the reassuring things that if you don't keep good precepts, whatever psychic powers you have, you lose them almost immediately. So you cannot abuse your powers, you know, to use it for personal gain or to harm other beings. Because as soon as you have thoughts of ill will or harm, all those powers, they're lost. So it's almost like a safety mechanism, like one of those earth leakage switches on the electrical circuit, so that if there is a short circuit, no one gets electrocuted. So if you lose your sila, you lose your powers at the same time. That's the, how do we know whether we have attained unshakable faith in a triple gem? Thank you very much. Okay, it means that there's no way you can get converted to any other religion. There's no way that you can think that there's a self somewhere, or that suffering is not all through samsara. So you have perfect faith, unshakable faith, because you've got wisdom. You've actually seen the truth. So it's sometimes you think you've got unshakable faith, but you have to keep going for a while, because it may be unshakable faith today, maybe this month, maybe this whole year, maybe the next 2, 3, 4, 5 years, but see if it's going to be there after 6 or 10 years. Sometimes a test of time is the only way you can find out whether those attainments are real. These 2 days I find myself headache, therefore I can't meditate, can't rest, can't read Dhamma books, and it's painful. I have tried to relax myself, but still painful. Please advise what I can do. Thank you. Now, what you can do is do nothing. You know, because meditating you can't do, you can't rest, you can't read Dhamma, you can't do things, so don't do things. Try doing nothing, or rather nothing doing. Because the reason why you've got a headache is because you're always doing something. You're always doing meditation, or you're doing reading, or you're doing relaxing. And sometimes we don't know the difference between doing relaxation and relaxing. But when you get it, when the sort of the penny drops and the light bulb goes on in your head, then you realize why you've got a headache and why you get stress. You just can't let go of this doer. So that person, whoever wrote this, please go and sit outside in the garden somewhere, go and look at a tree, and please don't move until you've seen that tree grow. Learn how to do nothing. That's my little trick, because you know what it's like in life. Now, if you sit at home and you want to meditate or you just want to relax, and your wife or your husband say, "What are you doing, darling?" I say, "I'm doing nothing." "Oh, come and help me." Because people don't respect it if you're doing nothing. If you say you're reading or you're cooking or you're fixing up, oh, they respect it. Okay, you know, I'll leave you alone. But if you say I'm doing nothing, it means that, you know, you're free to help someone else. So that's why I never say that anymore. If people say, "Okay, Prabhupada, what are you doing?" I never say nothing, otherwise they get me to do something. So I usually say, "I'm watching the trees grow." Well, it's, you know, something, which really means you're doing nothing, but don't say you're doing nothing. Okay. When we read a book on mindfulness, we always get sentences like, "Meditate on anger, meditate on a frown, meditate on a banana." Never seen that one before. Now, I think you must have heard right. So meditate on Nibbana, not banana. What does this mean? How can we do it? Could you give us an example? Okay, now you can't meditate on anger, and also you can't really reflect on anger while you have anger. Because anger means you're totally deluded. You've lost it. Your mindfulness is not present. That's why you get angry. But you can meditate on anger which has passed. What was that like and how stupid that was? Did that achieve anything? Who did I really hurt? I know who I hurt most of all, me. So you can reflect. Reflect means something has happened and you reflect upon it afterwards. You contemplate it. In the past, fine, but you're contemplating about an event which has happened in the past to try and understand it. And you get incredible insights. Now, anger is a great thing to contemplate. Why do you do that for? You've allowed someone to hurt you once, twice, for many minutes. You don't have to do that. Someone calls you a dog. And I think they call me a dog. Why do they call me a dog? They've got no right to call me a dog. I'm a monk, not a dog. And I suddenly realize they've called me a dog 4 more times. Every time I remember it, they're calling me a dog again. And what anger is, we keep dwelling on the pain of the past. So it keeps on hurting us again and again and again. When I look on it that way, anger is a stupid response. I'm allowing people to keep hurting me. I'm allowing life to keep hurting me. When I see it that way, it's so easy to let go. Yeah, you've called me a dog. You've abused me. You've cheated me. You've hurt me once. I can't stop that, but I'm not going to allow you to hurt me again. I'm not even going to remember it. I'm going to let it go. That way, you can only hurt me once. If you hit me, you can only hit me once. If you steal, you can only steal once. If you scold me, you can only scold me once. And most of the hurt comes when we keep thinking about it again and again and again. We allow hurt to continue. That's called anger. It makes no sense to me. Meditate on a flower. I think that must be like, again, looking at the flower's growth, which is basically doing nothing, which is great. So that's what maybe be. Anyway, I better hurry up because... How to enjoy fun in meditation without attaching to it. Now attach to it. The simile which I gave is like climbing a ladder. If you're getting onto the roof and you're climbing a ladder, you have to attach to the rung above you. Grasp it. So you can pull yourself up by something lofty and high. Now when you get up to that rung, soon you're standing on that. And that's the time to let it go. But if you don't attach to anything at all, you'll never get anywhere up the ladder. So attach to the good things, let go of the lower things, and as you go up the ladder, that which you once attached to, now you can let go, but not too soon. The Buddha gave the simile of the raft. The raft is for crossing over. And he said, once you've crossed over, then don't attach to it, but please don't let it go when you're halfway across. So remember the right time to detach and the right time to attach. That's why some people say, "Look, I'm not attached to this meditation. I'm going home this afternoon." That's stupid, isn't it? So no, keep on going. Attach to the beautiful things. Well, my teacher Ajahn Chah says, attach to your precepts. Don't throw them away. So attach to your stillness. and let go of the agitation and restlessness. Attach to the right things and let go of the bad things. And then you make a lot of progress in life. If you throw everything away, then you get nowhere. Throw the bad things away first. Keep the good things. And then maybe later on, the good things. You can sort those out to the very good things and the ordinary good things, and throw the ordinary good things away and keep the beautiful things. And then you have lots of progress. And so have fun in meditation. Look, I have fun teaching a retreat. And you see me, even I've got a sore throat, I manage to tell jokes and laugh and have a good time. And even that is a wonderful way of making sure you keep healthy. Every doctor knows. Remember, who's that guy? Patch Adams. You know Patch Adams? I think there's a movie made about him. So he made people laugh in hospital, and people got better. So when you make it fun, and you make it sort of joyful, you make much better progress in life, in education, and especially in meditation. And also, look, one thing which I noticed when I first became a Buddhist, look, these monks, they're supposed to be enlightened, or at least almost enlightened. And I knew enough about Buddhism that enlightenment is the end of suffering. So I wanted to see monks who have ended suffering, who were happy. I didn't want to see miserable monks. Many of my friends were already miserable. I want to see happy monks. Because the end of suffering is happiness. Nibbanam paramam sukham. Nibbana is the ultimate happiness, the highest happiness. So that, to me, meant the closer you get to Nibbana, the closer you get, the happier you are. And that's why living with someone like Ajahn Chah, this very, very happy monk, who was always doing weird things and telling jokes and laughing a lot. And that was such a relief to realize this path I was embarking on was a happy path. And I didn't need to be miserable. And you realize that miserable people are people who are still holding on to a lot of suffering. You don't know really how to let go. And the more you develop your meditation, the more you develop your wisdom, the more light-hearted you are. Easier to laugh, easier to smile. Even in the face of pain, you can still manage to laugh. Just again, like Chief Reverend laughing when he was told he had cancer terminal. That's a real monk. So not getting miserable. Oh, I've got cancer, I'm going to die. Unfair. I'm too young to die. I'm only, how old was he? 80? So don't get miserable. Your yesterday's talk about insight is so inspiring and motivating, especially Jhana. Wow, if you are not the monk, you'll become a very successful salesman. You mean I? Actually, not a salesman. This is actually true, that I was giving a talk in Melbourne many years ago, and in the audience there was a professional comedian who actually goes on TV in Australia. He's a TV personality, a comic on TV. And after hearing me give talks with a few funny stories, he came up to me to offer me a job. True. He actually offered me a job as a stand-up comic. And he said, your material is unique and your timing is perfect, and I know because I'm a professional, I go on TV. Why don't you become a professional stand-up comedian? That was very sweet. I never took him up on the offer, but you never know. No, of course I can't. I'm a monk. You made me stay in meditation hall almost the whole of yesterday, despite achieving nothing. You achieved nothing. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. That's the hardest thing to achieve. Emptiness. Wow. That's what you're supposed to achieve. Well done. All these people who try to achieve something, they're the ones who are going to get frustrated. So you're here to achieve nothing but to let go of things. Remember that. And then you understand the way of meditation. It's such a hard thing to get across. I'm not a good salesman because I have to keep on pushing the same point. Meditation is not about getting something. It's about losing things. It's about losing wanting. So you sit here and doesn't matter what you're experiencing, this is good enough. You don't want anything. End of craving, okay? Totally happy to be where you are. With a crazy mind, with a sore throat, with a painful body, hungry, restless, pleased, happy to be here, wherever that happens to be. If you can do that, you'll find the straight path to jhanas, enlightenment, the whole works. It's wanting stands in the way of the path. Craving leads to suffering. Third noble truth, letting go of craving, letting go of wanting, leads to nibbana. Even wanting good things, similarly of the raft, I say even abandon the good things, let alone the bad things. Sabang nalang abhinivesanaya. Nothing is worth holding on to, not even the good things. So let go of everything. Especially don't want anything. If you don't want anything, then you get so still, so peaceful. And you are on Buddha air. You sit there doing absolutely nothing, and all these mangoes fall into your hand. And it's brilliant. This is the path of the Buddha. So many of us, we follow the path of the world, trying, struggling, wanting things to happen, desiring, craving, and we get very frustrated in our meditation. Has you not understood yet why you get frustrated? Because you keep wanting things. And then suddenly you decide to let go. I'm going to give up. And then everything comes to you. As Buddhists, all of our ultimate goals is to attain nirvana, free from suffering, not to be born in this world again, but in meditation we cannot try it, want it, expect it, think about it. So what is the trick? Any middle path trips. Okay. Thanks a lot, have a wonderful day, enjoy your sore throat. Yes, I will, thank you very much. I'm having great fun with my sore throat. It's nice speaking in a voice which is sexy. No. Yeah, great story. This is, again, one of my original inventions of the donkey and the carrot. This is the donkey and the carrot metaphor. Once upon a time, there was a donkey, and the donkey was stubborn, as donkeys usually are, just like your mind. Really, really stubborn. And so the owner got out a big stick, a cane, and started hitting the donkey. But even if you hit the donkey with a cane, it still does not move. Doesn't matter how much you punish yourself, you force yourself, you still can't get your mind to meditate. But the owner, he had been to Ajahn Brahm talk. So he knew what to do with the stick. Don't hit the donkey with the stick. Tie the stick to the back of the donkey's head. So the front of the cane is about 2 foot in front of the donkey's head. Then go and get a piece of string. Tie the string to the end of the stick. So the other end of the string is about 2 foot in front of the donkey's mouth. Then get a nice carrot, or maybe a mango, or if the donkey comes from Penang, a nice durian. And put the durian on the end of the string. And there's the donkey looking at the durian. And donkeys, especially if they're from Malaysia, they like durian. And so they... Do you like durian? Yeah. So the donkey starts moving towards the durian. But because the durian's on the end of a string, tied to the end of a stick, tied to the donkey's back, as the donkey moves forward, so does the durian. And the donkey keeps following the durian, always thinking it can reach the durian, but never does. And that's the way the owner gets the donkey to move. Not out of ill will, but out of craving for the durian. But he's smart enough to know that donkey can never get the durian because it's always 2 foot ahead. Now those of you who have been meditating, isn't that the case? That the breath, nimittas, enlightenment, you can actually see it almost. And you go towards it and it goes away from you. That's the meaning of life. Happiness, fulfillment is within sight, but you go towards it and it goes away from you, just like the durian and the donkey. But not only the owner, the donkey had also came to Ajahn Brahm's talk, or at least he heard a CD, and the donkey figured out how to catch the durian, because the donkey, doesn't matter how hard he ran, It ran at 10 miles an hour, 20 miles an hour, 50 miles an hour. Still the durian went 50 miles an hour in front of the donkey. But the donkey realized how to catch the durian. He heard Ajahn Brahm say, "Stop, let go, put things down, stop running. Just be still, let it go." So the donkey stopped. And when the donkey stopped, he noticed the durian go further away. But the donkey had faith and patience. The donkey just waited until that durian was 4 foot away, never been as far from him ever before. But then something strange and unique happened. Then the durian started coming towards the donkey. That never happened before. And soon it was 2 foot in front of the donkey's mouth, but now coming at great speed towards him. He didn't need to do anything at all. He just stopped, was still patient, until the durian was so close to his mouth, he remembered the final teaching of compassion: "The door of my mouth is open to you, donkey." Durian. And the durian came into the donkey's mouth. That's how you catch durians. Or if it's in the West, how the donkey catches a carrot. You're already running fast enough, stop. And the carrot goes further away, and then it comes all the way back and into your mouth. Thank you very much. And that's exactly how you become enlightened. You've been running after jhanas, you've been running after enlightenment for so many years, so many lifetimes. And what do I say? Just stop, don't do anything. Stop rushing, stop craving, stop wanting things, stop doing anything. Just stop. And what happens when you stop? You let go. You get restless, you tell me, you get tired, you fall asleep, this can't be working, and I'm worse than I ever was before, maybe I should put forth effort, then I can watch the breath. No, be patient. I kept telling many of you, yeah, you get a bit sleepy at first, you get a bit restless, but don't interfere with the process. The durian is going further away from you than it's ever done before. You're more sleepy, more restless than you were before when you stop putting in effort. But wait, soon the durian starts coming towards you. Soon you can watch the breath so easily. But now, without any effort, it's coming deeper and deeper right in front of you. So all these nimittas, these jhanas, they're just coming one after the other. And you find you can catch anything when you stop. It's the same as putting your hand out. You don't shake anything, and the man goes forth. So that's a simile of the donkey catching the carrot. If you go running after things, in other words, wanting and craving, you never catch them. When you stop, yeah, they go further away at first, and then they come towards you. Thank you. It's that easy. But can you stop for long enough? Answer: very difficult. But give it a try, see what happens. That's how it works. Last question, actually, it's all question time, no talk, never mind. Good questions. As a father, and you love your only son very much, in the process of meditation you discover your only son is going to die, and die dreadfully. You also know when he is going to die and why he is dying. Will you tell him what you see? Will you stop this from happening? Can he stop this from happening to his son? What is your advice? Now, if that's like a prediction of the future is always very, very uncertain. You may think it's an omen, it's about to happen. Most of the times it does not happen at all. So remember what fear does. It creates these scenarios of the future which don't happen. So number one, whatever that prediction was, the chances of it happening are very, very, very small. And I wouldn't mind guaranteeing that. If you've had that vision just before a jhana or after a jhana, then those visions are very accurate. If that happened then I would be concerned. But I think most of the time, you found that the person's meditation, you discover your only son is going to die. A lot of that is exaggeration, not really the truth. So I think your son is going to be okay. And if you really think he's going to die a dreadful death, then send him to Bodhinyana Monastery and I'll be making him a monk, and then he'll die very peacefully and wonderfully in the robes and get a wonderful rebirth. But no, it's unlikely to do that. So I think it's mostly, this is exaggeration, mostly through fear. Remember what I said last night, when you're afraid a little mouse becomes a tiger. And through fear, a little sort of idea becomes a terrible idea, and you worry yourself sick, your only son, and you think he's going to die. And that's terrifying for a father. So if you come and talk to me about it afterwards, but my advice is 99% sure that that fear is unfounded. You've probably found your son is going to live to a ripe old age and be very happy. Okay, an interesting question. Fascinating, but please don't anyone else worry about it. It's not your son. You've got enough suffering as it is, without carrying other people's suffering on your shoulders. So, there goes another talk, and it was supposed to be a talk, it was question time, but I think, was that okay? Would you rather have a talk instead? Okay, well, tomorrow we'll have a talk. So please, one question per person now, and not 1A, 1B, 1C, 1D. Stop, don't cheat. So I'll try and give you one question per person, and that way we can do the questions, but also have a talk tomorrow as well. So thank you for listening, and remember, you're all donkeys, so please stop chasing the carrots or the durian or whatever else you like, and see what happens today, and have a wonderful time. And even remember, if the one meditation doesn't work, remember, you're just building up your credit, and the paycheck is coming soon. So just keep on meditating and meditating and meditating, and then the boss is going to pay you a big fat check. Whoopee. Happy meditating.